disastrous.
We're most definitely within what we're calling here perma-crisis. There isn't time to take stock. There isn't time to learn different lessons. So I think one of the big challenges, if you are in response, is to carve out really strictly time for that reflection.
Hi, this is Elizabeth McNaughton, and welcome to Disrupting Disasters, conversations with disaster experts about how we can do disasters differently. For this episode, I spoke to my friend Dr. Lucy Easthope. She is just so boss. She's the UK's top authority on disaster recovery and the author of this amazing book, When the Dust Settles. She's also brilliant. I always have these awesome conversations with Lucy, and I just wanted to invite others in on that experience. Now, before we jump in, I wanted to ask if you can hit subscribe or follow this podcast, you'll be the first to know when we drop new episodes. I think you should. Go on. Now, let's get into it. Welcome, Lucy.
Hello, everybody.
You know, I just loved your recent article in The New Yorker. And when thinking about how to introduce you, I thought I couldn't do better than the words in The New Yorker. So I'm going to borrow some of theirs to give the audience a sense of you. In another time or another place, Lucy Easthope says she would have been a fortune teller, a woman of opaque origin and beliefs, who travelled from campfire to town square, speaking of calamities that had come to pass and those which hung in the stars. Easthope, who is 44, is one of Britain's most experienced disaster advisors. Easthope might find herself immersed at a scene for days, months, or years. I am the collector of a very specific type of story and the keeper of a very particular type of secret sorrow. Her greatest fear is forgetting, that chain of learning from disasters, fragile and error-prone as it is, breaks one day, because then there is only despair. She describes herself as a noisy rememberer. Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
I love that. And, you know, I'm also a 44-year-old noisy rememberer.
So, wait a minute.
Isn't it? I just love this. So let's do some remembering together.
Yes, please. Yeah. Definitely.
And so I'm going to start off reading some passages from your book, and then we can share our experiences and stories of those things. I am what comes next. I am one of the country's top advisors on disaster recovery. I am called in to size up the scale of what is faced and what can be done about it. Police and local responders might only see a major incident like this once in their career, but I have seen them over and over again. Nuclear incidents, chemical attacks, pandemics, food shortages, fuel shortages, train and plane crashes, volcanoes, and tsunamis. Whoa, that's a lot.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, how do you handle the emotional work that comes with that, right? That is a huge and big experience. How do you manage that?
Well, I think that's a commonality, isn't it, amongst all emergency responders of some form, really. Is I think in order to survive in the field, you have to find very, very effective coping strategies. You know, I'm quite often now asked to come to things and talk to people who've been through a lot. And this sort of spirituality, I think, almost of connecting around the same sorts of feelings and experiences and how to process them is something that I'm really, really passionate about. So for me personally, it's been a kind of trial and error of what works. So that can be quite lighthearted. It can be talking about it. It can be the use of music. So I talk a lot about what I call my planthems, the music that gets me through. All the way through to my earlier stages of my career, a lot of my colleagues were American, and there was a very comfortable acceptance of seeking psychological support. And that's never been alien to me. You know, the British have a slight reputation for not really necessarily engaging with that. But for me, it was something that the Americans certainly treated as if you were going to the dentist. Sometimes you need a burnout monitor. Sometimes you need somebody to tell you you've lost perspective. I think that's a huge piece of advice and recovery guidance, and also that you might need more help than you think. So, I mean, I'd be very interested in what you do as well.
Yeah, well, I think back to my first biggie, and I think your first big event shapes you and stays with you in a very particular way. And so I was working on the Indian Ocean tsunami, and I was 27. You know, it was huge. And I'd been in the field, and I came back to speak to, you know, the big boss. And I was kind of expecting sort of like a metaphorical hug, you know, like you've done well in this and this and this. And I was explaining what had happened. And he just looked at me, said very, very plainly, "Great, you're now prepared for everything that's going to be worse." And at that moment, I didn't think that was particularly helpful. I was like, after this experience, this is what you have to say. But then as the years go by, I actually can see the wisdom in that, and that every event, I am very curious to ask questions, and I learn, I grow, and then I feel I am prepared for everything else that's going to be worse. And I'm actually, yeah, quite proud of that growth and that capacity. But the trick to it is to grow from this adversity is to take the time to rest, to restore, to reflect, to write as you do. And that's where the growth comes from. And I worry for a lot of people that are just going from a bang to bang to bang to bang to event, constant responding without that time. Whereas, you know, if we look at athletes, right, they go to a big event, they take the time to do all of those things, and they come back stronger. And I think it's the same for us.
Oh, I think that's so important. One of the things that emergency planners and responders had got perhaps used to was using what I might call kind of a period of fallow, very brief fallow between crises, to do that building back, to do that recovering. And that fallow isn't there anymore. We're most definitely within what we're calling here perma-crisis. And I think you can see it in both individual fatigue, but also in a lack of reflection generally. And I don't think in perma-crisis necessarily good decisions are made. There isn't time to take stock. There isn't time to learn different lessons. So I think one of the big challenges, if you are in response, is to carve out really strictly time for that reflection. And that's a big change that I've noticed. We've lost the parts of the emergency management cycle relating to lessons identified, review. We're just going from one thing to the next. And I think that's very, very challenging. And the other thing I think about that is not getting to kind of take stock of what the pandemic was or is, you know, and what it did. So I think there's some very big challenges for us when we're trying to particularly support younger colleagues at the moment in what kind of good, perhaps enduring response looks like.
Absolutely. And it's so difficult because I feel we're in a new chapter. Our world is in a new chapter. And as you said, this perma crisis, and that requires a system update. That requires a very different approach. And yet we are not having the space to think, to redesign, to co-design, to look at the type of systems, the type of measures that we need for this new world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that becomes more and more important. So this last year, with the book being out, more and more people have drawn me into climate discussions. And that becomes, I think, more relevant for there's an awful lot for climate scientists to learn from the recovery scientists, and likewise both ways. But also this point about looking again at perhaps how messaging is received, what is needed, what are the pitfalls. You know, disaster recovery writing and disaster recovery specialists like yourself are very good at challenging what might on paper at first glance look like a really good idea. And so with a lot of the solutions around, or potential solutions around climate, have on paper, you know, lots of merit, but it's the recoverers, the disaster recovery work that has really brought, I think, necessary challenge to that. So I think there's a sense that we need to find that time to take stock if we are going to be ready for what comes next.
Absolutely. And, you know, you've just taken my mind back to the first time I worked on what we'd call now a managed retreat. That was in the Maldives, relocating a community of 4,000 people to a completely new island home where all the infrastructure was rebuilt. Of course, it took a lot of time. It still remains one of the most intense and challenging pieces of work that I've been involved in. And through that process, you know, and interfacing continuously with these communities, you know, there was this sense of grief, this sense of loss that I couldn't articulate. And I actually haven't been able to articulate it in 20 years until I found it in your book. And so I want to read that. I'll just find the page. Here it is. I love this, Lucy. Rife is a longing for a place to which there is no return, an echo of something that can never be found, a heart sickness for something that no longer exists, and a time that can never be gone back to. The never-ending ache of Horife. And then you go on to say, but these places also taught me something, the value of a horizon to swim towards, the importance of trying to build something afterwards, but to stay living, breathing, there had to be a purpose, a future, and a bluer sky. I wish 20 years ago I had this concept. It just so beautifully articulates what is at the heart of things like a large-scale managed retreat. And I think if we sit in what that is, then our work with communities goes in the right direction. But yeah, I'd love to hear more about that concept, how it's been powerful to you.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's an interesting one because I think we're seeing more and more bringing together of climate science and disasterology, if you will. And so managed retreat is something we're seeing a lot more. These things become shorthand, don't they? And so I've just done a podcast where I was quite critical of perhaps the way that some climate scientists were quite simplistic about the way that they were using managed retreat. Well, there's a solution, it's managed retreat. And what I was saying was, to me, managed retreat made me think of Hiraeth. It made me think of, you know, forcibly removing somebody from a world that no longer it will exist, which is what disasters do. So rather, you know, of course, what we see policymakers and lawmakers try and do is present something as positive. Hurrah, you get a new village up the road. And we see that in disaster recovery as well. You know, we'll build a gymnasium back smarter than it was before. And you and I know that something stays missing, something stays lost. I was so grateful to find Hiraeth as a term. It is a Welsh word. It's a beautiful language. And where I'd first encountered Hiraeth was the writing on Aberfan, which was the loss of 166 children. I'll get my figures right, but about 180 people, 116 were children. And there were a coal slurry tip collapsed onto a primary school. And it was in a Welsh South Wales village. And what you started to see was some very, very, very deeply powerful and personal writing about the loss of the life before. And you can rebuild aspects of the town, or you can rebuild a school, but you're never going to get the life back. You're never going to get the life before. And I think one of the sadnesses about working in disaster recovery that you just have to find a way through is you are seeing people all the time who are experiencing Hiraeth. That's the most common theme. And I think the other thing that you will see, and certainly we had this in England and America, was that you would see a sort of desperate rush by modern mental health provision and mental health hospitals and trusts here that were delivering immediate support after disaster, was that they were sort of going to cure the trauma of the disaster. That was what they would do. And you would say, well, there's certain things you might be able to make better. You might be able to work with some of the traumatic memories or the images. You can't fix Hiraeth. And Hiraeth starts to imbue and embed itself in other bits of the recovery. So you find people, for example, become very discontented in their homes, in the new house that's built for them, they become very unhappy at work. And Hiraeth, I found with some community groups, unlocked an ability to accept once and for all the scale of the loss. So for me, it's the defining word. And like you say, it is exactly the word that sums up what I think both you and I have seen a lot of.
That's definitely a key aspect to our work, is how we lead others and support others through grief. See, difficulty is when you work at the community level, you feel the Hiraeth, you feel the rawness, you feel everything. So I've worked a lot in those situations, but then I've also worked at the heart of government. And then noticing, and we call it compassion leakage, you know, these very raw feelings of Hiraeth that where you start and then you know, you'll try and communicate that into a report or an email, and then maybe a bullet point from that might make it into a briefing. And then, but for a cabinet paper, that's anecdotal, you don't have evidence. And so that very raw and real feeling of the right, of that community, that compassion for that leaks as it goes up and through the system, until quite often you have a political and financial juggernaut that is recovery, with a lot of egos, a lot of territory, where communities are not spoke of around the table with some of these decisions. And I just wondered how you reconcile these two very different things.
I don't think that you necessarily can, because there's a necessary pessimism, isn't there, in writing about recovery, the done to, the exploitation, the capitalism, all the things that we see. And my academic book, and if people want to send me an email for an e-copy of that, because it's a ridiculous price as all academic monographs are, I'm very happy to oblige with an e-book of my academic monograph, which is called The Recovery Myth. And that was based on my PhD thesis. And that was basically this massive dissonance between what the state and the political parties and the civil service think is possible and what's happening on the ground. And what happened in 2007 was the UK basically pinched excellent recovery guidance from Australia and New Zealand. And we put out our own recovery guidance. And really there, in a very, very British plagiarism, but a very British way as well, it was, you know, if you follow these 25 steps, you will get to this, you know, you will get a recovery. I literally say in The Recovery Myth, you know, the idea of what people might feel was turned into Excel spreadsheets. We had 200 word templates that we could write up from different places that had been flooded or had a fire. And that would be submitted to the Cabinet Office as a list of all the things that worked. So I certainly think, you know, one of the things that you would see is just a complete disconnect. And even, I mean, one of the things that the wonderful thing about having the book out there and having people willing to interview me and stuff is how far you start to reach. And like really senior journalists saying to me, what do you mean it will take longer than 3 months? Like what? You know, and politicians and others, like, it's almost, you have to be careful not to form a sort of religion, because people are hanging off every word going, gosh, you mean it's intergenerational, you know, and it's 10 years, 20 years, you know. And I did an interview recently and somebody said, you know, how long will we remember the pandemic for? And I was like, a very long time. When will we not kind of feel all of it in our soul and our skin? I was like, maybe 30 years? And they were like, I don't think we can write that down. So I think one of the challenges with that dissonance between what policymakers want and what's happening on the ground is I am, and I know you are, we're very comfortable with the messy. We're very comfortable with the uncertain. And that's probably, if you're trying to hire me, my biggest weakness, because people will want absolute certainty. And you're also very aware that they want promises that this will get better. And even with something like the recovery graph, I see a lot of people focus on the uptick and go like, so that I can see the graph has an uptick. Like, that's good. When does that kick in? Not like the massive slump before and all of the other stuff that has to happen to mean you might get a slow, painful, slight improvement with the hiraeth. And you know me, this isn't cynicism. This isn't pessimism. We deliver all of this news with hope and optimism and a smile. We get our joy where we can get it. But we do need to build in a kind of real awareness, I think, of what on the ground recovering looks like.
It's so tricky to find that balance between hope and the painfulness of the experience and hope for people. And I love what you're saying, because in emergency management, you know, there's that real drive for control. I've been thinking about this a lot, really curious about how you see the role of control going forward, given permacrisis, given that we're in this new chapter of climate change. What kind of mindset do you think we need for this new world that we're in?
Well, I'm quite nervous about that because, as you know, I sort of tipped towards the end to raising some concerns about things like behavioral sciences. And what I started to find was that, for example, the recovery literature and the recovery guidance was very desirable by behavioral scientists as a sort of predictor of what humans might do. And I really started to worry about what Pandora's box had been open, because what you can find is a sort of ersatz recovery, a kind of false and fake recovery, where people look at the recovery graph and say, well, this is what we need to get people to hear. So rather than a kind of authentic response, something where, you know, we use the term here, and I think it is known globally, kind of a nudged response. So a lot of kind of manipulation of people's feelings. And one of the examples of that, we have big debates in the UK at the moment about the giving of donations after disaster. You'll know that on Twitter, I have a hashtag, cash not stuff, which is about donating money to DC or other charities, not donating secondhand goods. And there was some interesting dynamic about, well, actually, governments have always known that that was a good thing to do. But sometimes if a community is overwhelmed with donations, it gives them something to do. It's a distraction while the responders take too long to respond over here. And so one of the things I think is we're operating with a number of lenses. We are post-trust and we're post-truth. You've had a slightly different pandemic experience, but you still have issues, I think, with trust and truth in disaster response. We are in a world that will see populism. We're in a world that will see dissent. And I have a tricky relationship with misinformation, because at the start of the book, one of the things that I point out is that I'm from a community that was consistently told it was lying at the start of its disaster. So I'm really nervous when people say there is one truth after disaster. You know, when I'm at conferences and people say, what are the challenges as we go into climate? A lot of people's answers will tend to be around, you know, we're going to have to get a grip on these people spreading rumours, or these people asking difficult questions, or we need one truth. And that isn't where I'm at. I think we don't need to try and win truth. We need to try and be truthful. And those are different things. So I think I'm quite nervous about that aspect going forward. And I also think it's the classic thing you and I talk about a lot, and it's right there as we, you know, you're already, it's the 11th of September where you are already, it will soon be in a couple of hours for us. And that really was a day that the world changed. And of course, the Senate report into the attacks on 9/11 was called the failure of imagination. And that's the biggest challenge I think we face in emergency management, is we continue to be unimaginative. And that leaks into climate change. And it's not just imagination as to the causes of the event, it's imagination into the harms done. I mean, hiraeth is not a mainstream harm. It's huge, but it's not something you can take into a government COBRA meeting and say, I'm really worried about the hiraeth. You know, what you're supposed to take in is there's a smoke plume or there's this information. So one of the difficulties we have, and I've had consistently as an advisor in emergency response, is I have a wild imagination. A lot of colleagues share it, but very few leaders have that wild imagination.
I love that, because we need to reimagine our systems, our mindsets, the possibilities that this change, these changes offer, right? Like, we're on the frontier here. And yeah. You know, this is a world now where everyone is a responder. So, you know, if we change our mindset to think everybody is a responder, then how do we support that? How do we bring people into that new world with what we know already, you know? There was a couple of lines in your book where I just thought, oh my goodness, we just had exactly the same moment. And I'd like to share that with you, Lucy. So I was working on the Canterbury earthquakes, and I was traveling a lot between Wellington and Christchurch. And, you know, it'd been a huge, huge time, very, very demanding. And my boy, he was 3 at the time. And he looked up at me and he said, "Mummy, do you live at the Red Cross?" Oh, Lucy, I just had, you know, it was a very powerful moment for me. And, you know, my boy asked me just the right question at just the right time. And actually, I finished my recovery work following that question. And then I went and did a review of New Zealand's legislation for disaster risk reduction with no people and a change of focus. But he did that for me, you know. And I think so much in leadership and so much in the crisis leaders that we work with, it's those that ask the right questions at the right time in the right way that are powerful in this work. And it's an art, actually, to creating these questions. And then I read about your Mabel. I'd love you to share her question and the impact that that had on you.
Yeah, so she, you know, she was 3 as well. You know, may we all be blessed with the wisdom of 3-year-olds. And one of the chapters, and without a doubt, it's one of the hardest to write, is the Grenfell fire chapter. And, you know, one of the things that I think when you see responses from around the world, one of the things you and I both collect in our experiences and our lives is what I call the silvery threads that connect them. And obviously with the Christchurch earthquakes, what killed the vast majority of people in the second quake was fire. And a British team went out to do identification. And the same team did the Grenfell identifications. And I often think when people talk about unique or unprecedented, they don't see that actually there are brothers and sisters from across the world who learned, you know, we learned techniques in New Zealand that were then employed in Grenfell. And Grenfell was a fire in a tower block here in London. At least 72 people died. I make that point in the book why I say at least. And one of the most difficult things about that fire was it was very, very predictable, very preventable, and very, very close to home for me, because for about 3 years previously, I'd been working on research, sort of looking at whether we were ready to respond to something like that. And I presented the data that said we weren't the day before. So at about 3 o'clock on the 13th of June, and the fire began that night. And, you know, the book says some things, but the wonderful thing about Sam Knight's writing in the New Yorker profile was he took the story on a little bit more, and he talked about the toll on me. And I think one of the things there was I felt like I'd utterly failed. And I think one of the difficulties about doing this work is it's not necessarily that you hook it to your ego, but you hook it to your soul. And if you fail at it, you do feel an utter failure. And of course, you know, it's a huge arrogance and huge kind of inaccuracy to think that you could have any kind of control over this. And I explore that in the New Yorker piece. But I still felt on a personal level like the field and the profession had failed. But also, it was just particularly horrifying. And I think also it was cumulative. So you'd reached this point where you'd seen preventable loss so often. And I threw myself into elements of the responding and also really kind of overworked for a couple of years afterwards. And Mabel took my face in my hands and said, "Where have you gone? Where have you gone, Mummy?" So, you know, 3-year-olds, you talk a lot about the value of people, you know, who will truth tell. And my advice would be find yourself a toddler. Because probably one you know, like not just any toddler, for a number of reasons. But as you say, it goes right in and you hear that. And also, I think there was this kind of lofty idea that I had when they were first born, my children, that I would sort of explain to them, well, mummy is these things and that's important and it's more important than you. And then you realize that actually nothing's going to be more important to them. You know, at three and even at, to be fair, at 13, as we both know, they're pleased and they might get you to do a talk at the school, but ultimately they're going to guilt trip you till the end of time if you're not at that sports match. So it's very interesting. And I think the other thing about that moment was Mabel's a bit like a mini me, and it was very timely intervention, as yours was as well. Surround yourself with people and give people permission, I would say, to make those timely interventions. So actually in active response, actively appoint people that you will listen to. So many people will say to me, oh, I know I'm doing fine. And then if you ask their partner or their mother or the, you know, somebody they live with, how are they? They'll say, it's like they've died. They're a different person. They're not operating. They've gained weight. They've lost weight. They're completely haunted. So appoint people in your life that will help you. I also think the thing with Grenfell was, it's not, working in disaster is not inherently traumatic. It doesn't need to be. What traumatizes me is what I call in the book, the toxic nuggets. When things have failed, when you're having to keep secrets, when things are so obviously wrong. And that's very, very difficult.
Yeah. Thinking about our young ones and thinking about the future that they're inheriting, I hit this moment, I asked myself a question. I thought, okay, if I was hit by a bus tomorrow, what would I regret? And I thought it would be that I teach all of these people all of these things that I've learned through disasters, but I haven't prepared my own boy for the uncertainty and the permacrisis that he is growing into. And, you know, that weighed on me. And so as we've been discussing, a project I'm working on is I'm writing letters to my son to share what I've learned to help guide him in this world of uncertainty, a sort of mum's manifesto for an uncertain world, if you like. I'm thinking for you and for your kids, how are you using this work to help shape them? Or how are you managing the anxiety that comes with your children on the climate frontier?
Yeah, and it's so interesting, isn't it? I often think with some of the climate change discussion, there's a huge assumption that nothing else will get in the way before then. You know, like as we sit, you're slightly further away from conflict, but we obviously in Europe are in the middle of a very terrifying international war at the moment. You know, and there's always other things. And in chapter 7, I tackle some of those big fears, things like we genuinely in the UK, the first few briefings on the Fukushima event were very, very negative. And I remember I tried a long time to have my first daughter, Elizabeth, and she just arrived. And then I was like, well, that's a bloody irony because now the world's ending. And so I think one of the things was I try and parent in a swim lane separate from it. Now, we do have chats at home about power cuts, generators, hurricane lamps, stranger danger. We have some good emergency planning protocols. They sort of know what I do, but get very confused. But generally, I am very, touch wood, with only a few exceptions, my biggest lesson of my life is to live it and to live it with great delight. So I often tweet pictures of like one of them will be halfway up a climbing wall or the other will be bungee jumping or they'll be, you know, my older daughter is a show jumper. And it makes no sense at all in my in my risk world. But I think people assume that disaster planning and disaster planners are discomforted about risk. And I don't think that's true at all. I think we live life with a very great certainty of how fragile it is. So why would you not seize the day? We're sensible, we have pensions and a small ISA, but apart from that, live, love, laugh. And I do get into a lot of trouble for my use of affirmations on bathroom wall and various other things, but I think you and I are very similar in that, you know, life is so precious and so exciting that I wouldn't want to bring that home to them. There was a lot of psychological work that I did, and I'm sure you're the same, about managing the terror. But I think that's parents anywhere end up doing that. So no, I'm a great believer in that. And then I think the other thing is disaster recoverers, people working in emergency planning, have a particular personality type. We have particular ways of working. My littler daughter has similar, but my older daughter is not that at all. And what that has helped me with is understanding my colleagues, which again, I think you bring out a lot, and I know you're going to do more of that, is understanding the team. I often look back on some of my early jobs and I feel very bad for my past bosses because I didn't realize quite how different I was. Like, it didn't go quite as much as I feared with the New Yorker profile, but there were some questions along the lines of like, what was she like to work with in her 20s? And people were a bit like, oh. So, yeah, my kids are not me. And that, it sounds a very simplistic revelation, but that was important, I think.
Yeah. Oh, that resonates so much with me, that understanding what's really important in life and grabbing that with both hands and looking for delight. Like, I seek it, I design it. It's beautiful. The one thing, we've just got a few minutes left. I could talk to you all day, mate, really. But I just want to share something, you know, that really gets up my goat. For 20 years, I've heard this phrase, a manifestation of it in different ways. But it's always this idea that we're building the plane as we're flying it. Yeah. And I'm hearing it all over the place at the moment. And then I read in the New Yorker this piece, has no time for people who believe they are dealing with something that no one has suffered before. Don't go there with unique. Don't go there with unprecedented. Don't go there with, this is a terrible incident, we couldn't have the scene. She said, you are walking plowed, furrowed fields that other people have walked, and they are here to guide and support you. And I read that and I was like, yes, yes. We can do better than building the plane as we're flying it. And that is a big part of our mission, is to walk alongside people in this process, to build these systems, to build that capacity.
And that's so important to capture in training. And if you're going back into the workplace and saying, you know, what was that seminar on? There is something very intoxicating about the unique. And what I love, I mean, I use Twitter as another one of my psychological debriefing tools. But one of the things I love now, and it's international, but also a lot in Britain, is if a minister tries to sort of get themselves out of a disaster at the moment by saying, well, this was unprecedented, so we couldn't have planned it, I can expect about 100 tags in the first hour going, I think Lucy Goback would have something to say about that. And I love that, you know, long may that reign, because it's laziness, it's very alluring. A senior commander likes to think that he or she is walking that path for the first time. And it also is a foil for the errors that come. One thing we both mentioned being 44, I think one of the privileges that comes with getting to 44 is you can have a very angry kind of Paddington stare when somebody, you know, well, what are we going to do about this incident? You're like, no.
Oh, yeah. And so we'll keep on, Lucy.
God spare us from unprecedented. It's literally a campaign now.
It is. And we've got some noisy rememberers around the world. We've got a crew. We can have a plane much more ready to go, waiting in the hangar for takeoff.
The next thing you have to tackle is how to do it, because one of the things, like, you guys do it so much better than me. You are much better diplomats and you train people to do it so beautifully. But like, one thing at meetings when somebody does it, there is a diplomacy to saying no, it's already happened before. And what I tend to find is, very sadly, they have to experience some of the things that the recovery guidance says will happen. And then I get this phone call about 14 weeks in going, come back. We believe you. It is, in fact, precedented. So if we could crack that, I think that would be the biggest humanitarian change we could make in both climate and disaster.
Absolutely. And very much to that point, we have a disaster recovery workshop coming up. So if anyone would like to get in touch about how we can really help your organization, help leaders to build capacity for this stuff. And one of the key things, Lucy, you may hear this too, is that people do a training and then they say, I wish I'd known this like at the beginning, or I wish I'd known this a few years ago. So let's get ahead of that And yeah, we're here to accompany. We all are. And as a follow-up, Lucy has mentioned a number of amazing resources. We'll be putting that in the show notes for all of you. So you'll have that. And then to close, Lucy, maybe if we share the card for calamity we've chosen for each other. So curious which one you've chosen for me. These are our cards for calamity that help navigate life after disaster.
And I also thought when you book your next conversation, because I know you've got some exciting people potentially lined up, if you could hold this one for them as well. So this was the obvious one. If you think you are too small to make a difference, try sleeping with a mosquito. So recovery is a collective effort. A lot of citizens doing little things will make a difference. Everybody brings something different to the effort. You might be the kind listening ear. You might be able to explain an assistance grant. You might be handy with a hammer. So the question would be, what is your little thing?
Oh, that's beautiful. Oh, I love that. I am so going to ask that of the next disastrous guest. The one I would like to share is there is so much disasters can teach us if we're open to it. We generally don't volunteer to learn life's tough stuff, but our most valuable lessons come packaged in adversity. Many people who experience a traumatic event grow in some way. New strengths can come in the form of closer relationships, the opening of new possibilities and skills, a deepening spirituality, and appreciation for what's important in your life. This growth does not take away from the pain or loss from disaster. Post-traumatic growth, as it's known, can be seen as wisdom acquired under extreme circumstances. And Lucy, I just want to thank you so much because that is what you do. You share your wisdom and gained under extreme and often very difficult circumstances and at a cost to you. And you share that so beautifully with the world in so many ways. And I can't tell you the number of moments reading your book. I just like, yes, on the couch. Just so wise and so true. So thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Kia ora.
Hey, you made it to the end. Thanks for listening. A little reminder, if you enjoyed this podcast, please help us out and subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite platform. Even better, share it with someone in your network who might find it interesting.
You can also find more information and resources at disastrous.co. See you next time for another
Disrupting Disasters.